On today's episode of It's Always Something in Philadelphia, we'll get into the Eagles making headlines again for another stupid reason. Seems to be the only chance they have to get into headlines recently. We'll talk about the Sixers. We have a new player entering the fold. Anthony Tolliver joined the Sixers. We'll get into that a little bit, as well as talk about the Sixers matchup with the shorthanded Nets this evening and the race for the one seed in the East. Then we'll get into the Phillies. The Phillies, after a very hot start, have slowed down, losing four of their last five. We will talk about what is going wrong, as well as what are some of the holes for this Phillies team that we see that we can imagine aren't likely going to change anytime soon. Before we get started, today's episode is brought to you by Viget. Viget is the first ever social media for sports bettors. Viget has all sorts of great information, information on betting lines, information on public betting, all sorts of lines, any line you can imagine. You can find it on Viget. You bet free Viget coins, you win real prizes. You can join our betting league. Download Viget, use promo code Philly when you sign up. That's P-H-I-L-L-Y. And interact with us on the app. Thank you to Viget for being our sponsor. Without further ado, here is the intro from Harry DeMarco. Welcome to another episode of It's Always Something in Philadelphia. Along with Alec Leipsch, I am Kenny Adkins. And Alec, the weather is finally starting to get nice. It is springtime, finally. The baseball season is in full swing. Everything is good. The vibes are good. The NFL season is not upon us yet, nor is it very close. But somehow the Eagles have still found a way to be extremely discouraging.
Yes, they have. This report from The Athletic that came out this week is very telling of some things that you, I, and most of the city of Philadelphia already had a general idea of.
Yeah, so if anybody missed it, there was an article that came out this week written by three people actually collaborated on. So it was Sheil Kapadia, Bo Wolf, and Zach Berman. And the article headline kind of tells you everything you need to know. The article is called Paranoia, Mismanagement, and Office Politics: Inside the Eagles' Downfall Under Jeffrey Lurie and Howie Roseman. So that pretty much kind of puts it into perspective exactly what is going to be covered in what was ultimately a pretty scathing article. I think, like you said, we all kind of knew that there was issues with the management of the Eagles in the front office under Jeffrey Lurie and Howie Roseman. But to see them put out so plainly and in our face definitely does not make me feel good. What did you kind of take away from the article? What was the main gist of what was going on?
I got a lot of that Jeffrey Lurie is very involved in football operations, which is something most of us knew. In terms of relative to the other 31 owners in the NFL, he's one of the more involved. Some would say, even in the article, they say that he's kind of the only football owner who it's his first job is running the Eagles. I guess you could count Jerry Jones in that department too. So that's pretty telling of how he's going to run the team. And it's been evident in how the Eagles have gone about their draft picks, their signings, their overall football strategy. A few of their draft picks were even credited to Jeffrey Lurie, like this guy. So they picked him. One of them was Jalen Reagor. Another was Jalen Hurts. Good times. So, and the other thing that we all kind of knew already was that Howie Roseman is very good buddies with Jeffrey Lurie, which explains a lot because Roseman has been with the organization since 2000 and is the only GM in Eagles history to now have gotten to hire four head coaches. He's had a position a lot longer than a lot of people think he should have. And it was outlined in this article why he's basically a yes man to Lurie.
Yeah, that part of the article where it said that he'd been around for four head coaches was the one part where I was kind of like, holy shit. I mean, this guy has been here forever. And it like crossed my mind in such a way where I was like, at what point do they kind of reassess? Maybe it's not the coaches. Maybe it's the personnel decisions and all that kind of stuff. That this guy is outlasting four NFL head coaches. one of which won the only Super Bowl in the team's history. Yeah, like you said, that's something we've talked about extensively in the past. Those guys are best buds, it seems. And it's something that has created what seems to be a pretty toxic environment in the entire organization. The article talked a lot about how the coaching staff and the draft department and the analytics departments and the scouting departments, nobody seems to be on the same page at any given point in time. And nobody seems to really understand who is making the decisions or where the decisions are coming from. There are a few names mentioned in particular. I think one of them was, his name was Alec Hallaby. And he is the vice president of football operations, I think, under Howie Roseman. And he is, they talked about him having a very similar background to Roseman, not really a football background, kind of a bright-minded guy who's very analytically driven. And he has caused somewhat of a rift with the scouts in the scouting department, because he has been grading players in a way that he seems to have made up a method, and it kind of rubs guys the wrong way. And then they talked about with the draft this past season how the draft guys and the guys making personnel decisions in the scouting department got a list of players that had been graded, and they just had different things noted about them that just seemed to be guys this Hallaby guy liked, without any explanation of why he liked them or what exactly he liked about them. And that's something that we've seen from Lurie too, is him just kind of fixating on a certain guy and making the move to go get them. So it seems to me that there still is no direction in this front office with this team, that nobody really has any clear idea who has the, well, they know who has the final say. That's Lurie and Howie, but they don't seem to understand how they get to the decisions they make, which is extremely discouraging.
Well said, man. That was a hell of a rant, and a nice way to wrap it up. Nice way to put a bow on it. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the stuff in here, the most interesting specific tidbit was how Doug Peterson and the front office butted heads for like the past year. Peterson wanted to keep Frank Reich on. Makes sense to me. The organization didn't for whatever reason, and they moved on from Reich. And then they threatened to, if Peterson did not fire Mike Rowe and the other coordinator, I believe, forgive me for forgetting his name, that they would also fire him a year ago. And so Peterson fired them. And then after Peterson was let go, Lurie said in the press conference that Peterson did not deserve to be fired. So I'm not really sure did he deserve to be, you wanted to fire him years ago. So I don't understand what we're doing here.
It seems kind of decisions are being made and there's a lack of accountability. And everybody is kind of being like, oh, don't look at me. This wasn't my decision. This, you know, I would have done things differently, when clearly somebody has to be the one making those decisions. The Mike Rowe decision was interesting to me, because Mike Rowe is a guy that I think a lot of Eagles fans wanted to see gone. But there is something to be said about a head coach being able to pick his assistant coaches. And even if they had a down year production wise, he was the offensive coordinator, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So even if they had a year where they struggled offensively, that doesn't necessarily mean that they should immediately jump ship from a guy, especially if your head coach wants to retain him. There's something to be said about building rapport between coaches. So that seemed like right off the bat, that was something that kind of caught my eye. And just we know that coaches shouldn't have full autonomy when it comes to picking their players and stuff like that. I mean, we've seen that with, I mean, dare I say Chip Kelly, I don't want to bring that name up, but he was a disaster when he was put in the GM role too. But there is some credence to letting a coach pick their staff and making sure they have guys who are on the same page as them and know how to implement the game plans they want to implement. They also talked about in the article about how there was a 3-hour meeting with Jim Schwartz in 2017 prior to the season, and word had spread throughout the building that it seemed as though they were kind of preparing Schwartz to take over in the event that Doug Peterson had got off to a slow start. A lot of people believe that if they had started off poorly, mind you, this is 2017. We all know what happened in 2017. If they had started off slowly, they would have fired Doug Peterson, which it would have been only – he would have coached at that point 17 games for the Eagles, assuming they did it after week one. They were going to get rid of him and hire Jim Schwartz as a head coach. They're just – there's really very little direction, it seems. And with something coming up as important as the draft, I'm concerned that we are not anywhere close to them turning it around and starting to go down the right path.
Definitely not. Great transition. It seemed as at first that them trading down from number 6 to number 12 in this year's draft was a bit of a value move kind of thing, not liking who was available at 6 or who they thought to be available. But now, with all this context, it seems like they don't know what they want at 12 or at whatever their first round pick is. That's me putting these pieces together in a very reactionary way, which we all love to do as fans. But that's what it seems like to me is the Eagles have no idea what to do this year because they're so screwed.
Yeah, that was one of my main gripes with the move they made to move out of the 6 spot to 12, picking up future capital. It doesn't matter how many more picks you have if the person making the decisions is an idiot. I mean, just because you have – it's like I'll give you two dimes for your quarter. It's like that kind of thing where they're picking up extra first rounders, but they're picking up later in the draft where there's a lot more variance between talent level of players. There's a lot higher of a chance that they're going to completely whiff on those picks. That's why I wanted them to just stay at 12, and they would have almost. I mean, like I said, it is the Eagles making decisions, so they could have completely messed up 6 too. But they had a much higher chance of picking a legitimate NFL caliber player at that pick as opposed to 12. And now there are still going to be good guys available at 12. Whether they make those picks, we still have yet to see. But it just the move they made in theory was a smart move for team building, especially when you have as many holes as the Eagles do, like we've talked about in the past. But if they don't know what they're doing with the draft capital they've picked up, then who knows what's going to happen? I mean, seriously, there's In my eyes, very little reason to be optimistic that this draft is going to be a success. Now, we will still do our draft preview next week, and I'm sure we're going to talk ourselves into it being a great draft, but I don't know.
Maybe Vinny can spice it up when he comes on next week or the week after.
Exactly. Yeah, we're going to have Vinny on next week. The draft is 2 weeks from this Thursday, so April 29th, first round. So we're going to have Vinny on next week for a draft breakdown, a little preview action. We'll give you some of our picks, guys we like, but doesn't mean that they're going to take them. You know, I mean, it's discouraging, man. It sucks. I want them to be so bad again.
I'm genuinely interested in this report from Kapadia, Wolf, and Berman, which are – they're the three Eagles beat writers of The Athletic. That's why it was the three. There was like a comprehensive, like, tell-all kind of thing. I wonder what prompted – them to release it now or like what, who they were hearing this from. Obviously Doug Peterson's camp gave him some info. There were several other guys in the front office. I mean, for Alec Halliby to be directly called out, there's someone, I mean, not that they have malicious intent, they're probably just trying to tell the truth, but there's always some sort of agenda from somebody trying to get this info out. It's just, it's really interesting how it all comes together. This is for any sort of big report like this that comes out. Like, everyone was interested how the Colangelo burner account scandal came out the way it did. It's just, I'd be fascinated to find out where this all came from.
Yeah, no, it is definitely interesting timing with having it be so close to the draft decision. The draft decision, I guess that makes sense. But it's the article largely talked about drafting as the drafting and then the conflict with the coaches and the front office. But the draft was one of the main focal points in the article. And it just, I don't think it's coincidence that it's coming out so close to the draft time. It's maybe supposed to put more heat on them as they make their decisions on draft night. I don't know, but it definitely, there definitely is something to be said about the timing with draft night being only 2 weeks away. So Hopefully, this lights a fire under Howie Roseman's ass and he makes some good picks. But based off what we've seen in the last few years, I don't think we could I don't think we should have come to expect that.
No, I won't expect that either. I expect Jeffrey Lurie to make the picks.
Well, yeah, that's also part of it. That's its own issue. Moving away from the dumpster fire Eagles, I feel like that's like the sixth time I've referred to them as the dumpster fire Eagles over the course of this podcast. But you know what? It just until they prove otherwise, they're going to be the dumpster fire Eagles to us. Let's talk about the Sixers, the most successful team in Philadelphia right now. Hey, we have a new player, Alec. What can you tell us about Anthony Tolliver?
Anthony Tolliver is the definition of a journeyman. This is his 11th team in 13 seasons. Kind of like how Bill Russell won 11 titles in 13 years, the Celtics, but this is Anthony Tolliver being on 11 NBA teams in 13 years. He has not played for anyone this year. He was most recently seen on the Grizzlies and Blazers last season. He really kind of does the same thing as Mike Scott. He's just a stretch four kind of thing. But he's been around the block. He's very experienced, and chances are Doc Rivers is giving him a chance to compete for Mike Scott's role in the rotation and potentially for the playoffs, which would just be if Tolliver or Mike Scott are in the playoff rotation, something went terribly wrong. But there's also a chance that, like how Mike Scott has been playing center minutes these past few weeks while Embiid was hurt, that Tolliver will also get a look at center, and maybe one of them can become a capable stretch five. There's not really much. This wasn't like a big move. Not that any of us expected some sort of life-altering move from the buyout market, but it's something to look at. If he gets minutes, there will obviously be a reason why. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think you kind of said it, that we don't really expect him to be in the playoff rotation. And hopefully we don't expect to see Mike Scott. I could honestly see Mike Scott playing a little bit in some of the earlier series. I would rather go with Anthony Tolliver, I think, just based off what we've seen from Mike Scott. He has such erratic shooting and really nothing else that I would rather kind of roll the dice with a guy who's been around for as long as Tolliver has. No, he's not exponentially better than Mike Scott is, but he does – hopefully bring something else that Mike Scott doesn't. But yeah, I mean, it's really not something really to look too much into. It's a veteran player getting a shot to maybe crack the rotation. You had an interesting point when it first happened. Why in the trade for George Hill, why not have you mentioned that the Sixers should have just pursued a guy like Mike Muscala over exploring the free agent market and signing Tolliver. Do you still think that would have been a smarter move as opposed to signing Tolliver, or are you more confident with this one?
I think adding Muscala, the reason they probably didn't is simply because of the money implications, because that's an extra $2 million to an already pretty heavy luxury tax bill. Could have just been that, when you could just sign a guy like Tolliver to a 10-day, probably just cost-benefit analysis type of stuff. But, yeah, I mean, Tolliver, he's not good. He's not good at basketball. Like, he's like at best a backup stretch sort of big, because he's not too much of a defender either. We'll see. I mean, I don't know if he's better than Mike Scott. We will find out over the next week. But his 10-day contract, his first one's already like 5 days up. Like, this game he's playing against Brooklyn will be his first one. But I'm pretty sure he's already been on the team for like 5 days. So unless they're signing him to another one, which you can sign a player for up to two before you got to give him a real contract, we might only see him against Brooklyn and on Friday night.
Well, who knows? Maybe he's just going to come out and just start bashing skulls, and we'll have the Anthony Tolliver game. But I don't know. I don't have my hopes up for that. What's going on with George Hill too? I mean, we haven't seen him yet. Obviously, we knew coming over that he was injured. He had a thumb problem. But Doc Rivers said in this past week that there really is no timetable for his return. That's obviously concerning with the season winding down and him, you know, he figures to be – I mean, we talked a lot about him being a huge rotation piece for the Sixers. He needs to build that chemistry with the guys on the team. So are you concerned about his lack of a presence with this team right now? And do you think there's a chance that we don't see him until the playoffs?
I think there is a chance, actually, that we don't see him until the playoffs, which would be insane given the circumstances. But also, if anybody is able to just go from straight up not playing for a few months to being a part of a championship rotation, championship aspiring rotation, then it's George Hill, because he's the definition of just plug and play. He's a plug and play guard. So, and he's been around the block. He's 34 years old, and he's been on a lot of good playoff teams. He was on a lot of good Spurs teams, the Raptors.
Cavs.
You might have to cut that. He was on the Cavs championship team. The team that went to the finals in 2018. And also the Bucks team that went to the conference finals in 2019 that lost to the Raptors. That's where I got that from.
There you go.
I mean, it is worrisome, because we want to see how he fits into the rotation and also whose minutes he takes away from. We just want to see what it looks like, kind of. But I don't know. He seems pretty confident, because he was also asked about this, about like if he's going to be ready for the playoffs. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'll definitely be ready for the playoffs. And he seemed to be having good vibes with the guys during the Mavericks game on Monday night. So maybe he's already – maybe he's ready. Maybe he's just incubating.
Yeah, you said it best with he is the true definition of a plug-and-play type guy. That's kind of what I was going to suggest. His skill set is – pretty malleable, and he can kind of fit into whatever lineup they have on the floor. So I'm not super concerned as I would be with a guy who maybe plays a different position. But it still is a little concerning that we have yet to see him yet, but you know, who knows? He's obviously done it before, so he knows what it takes. And you know, he plays a position of need for the Sixers. So we're definitely going to see him at some point. But as for the Sixers that do play actually on the team, they will match up tonight against the Brooklyn Nets. The Nets are sitting LaMarcus Aldridge, Kevin Durant, James Harden, Blake Griffin. I almost called him Brooke Griffin. Pretty much the majority of their top five or six players. Kyrie is possibly going to play, but this is a good opportunity for the Sixers to get a leg up over the Nets in the battle for the one seed, which is still a very hotly contested race. What do you expect to see from the game tonight? It hasn't been announced who's playing for the Sixers, but I would imagine most of the regulars are playing.
I see a similar outcome to what happened on Monday, where Embiid completely dominates whoever the Nets throw at him. I do want to see how Nets backup center Nick Claxton handles him, because we're all pretty confident that Embiid can thrash DeAndre Jordan. But Claxton's kind of a different kind of defender, and he could be the Nets' like most important center in the playoffs, which will be very important for the Sixers to go up against. Also, however Jeff Green handles him, it's also possible that Embiid doesn't play tonight because of everybody else who's not playing for the Nets, which we must say the Nets played yesterday against the Timberwolves because the game got pushed back. We don't want to make any snap judgments as to why Nets players are sitting. I saw a lot of Philadelphia fans doing that today. It's like, dude, read the room. Like, not cool.
Yeah, no, I understand that as well. And I'm certainly not criticizing the Nets for sitting out a good portion of their players tonight, especially when they weren't expecting to have back-to-back. But I think it would be potentially beneficial if we sat Embiid tonight. They're not coming off a back-to-back, but, you know, any opportunity you get to give him a little bit of extra rest, especially in a game that it does matter, because we are currently tied with them for the number one seed, both at 37-17. It does matter to win this game, but it's one that we should definitely have in hand with or without Embiid. So I want to watch him play. I'm always disappointed when Embiid doesn't play, but it would be beneficial for them to maybe give him a little bit of rest. But you know, like I said, winning this game is a big deal. I mean, it would give them a whole game up over the Nets, with how many games are left?
18 total. So after that would be 17.
With 17 left to go. I mean, that's big. Right now, if the season ended today, the Sixers would draw the Knicks in the first round matchup, which would be a pretty favorable matchup for the Sixers. Really, that 7-8 seed. Really, well, I guess they still have to do the play-in and everything too. But the one seed is going to be huge for the Sixers to get. Do you think that they can hold the Nets off the rest of the regular season and end up with that one seed, or what? How do you envision it panning out?
I give them better odds to do it because I think the Nets are going to. I mean, this is a pretty good microcosm of the Nets' strategy. Is they are more. They're more concerned with getting to the playoffs upright than just forcing the issue kind of thing. So I could definitely see the Nets falling to the two seed and the Sixers getting one. But like you said, with the play-in tournament, we actually don't know who the Sixers would play in the first round until the play-in tournament is complete. So the matchups, you know, they're just up in the air at that point. It's just about getting home court advantage throughout the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously something we love to see for the Sixers because over the past few years, they've been exponentially better at home than they have been on the road. So, and especially with fans starting to come back slightly, that would be a huge bonus for the Sixers to be able to play at the Wells Fargo Center for the duration of the playoffs. So, obviously pulling for the Sixers to get the one seed. I think there's a pretty good chance they do it. If they didn't lose it while Embiid was gone, I don't think there's a chance they're going to give it up now. I think they know how important it is to get that one seed, and I think they're going to be gunning for it. So, it'll be exciting for the Sixers to be able to win the regular season crown in the East if they're able to do so. Moving away from the Sixers, like we said, the Sixers play the Nets tonight. This might come out tonight. I don't know. Otherwise, we will obviously not know what happens. So you guys will have known how the game turned out by the time you listen to this. Moving to the Phillies. So the Phillies, we were kind of on cloud nine with them for the first week plus of the season. The last week has been kind of rough. The Phillies have lost four of their last five. The only game that they won was on a very controversial safe at the plate call on Alec Boehm. Some of the ugly facets of the Phillies that we envisioned coming into this season have started to rear their heads, and they have been struggling over the past week. What have you seen from the Phillies over the past week plus? And what do you think it kind of could be mainly attributed to?
One, the peaks and valleys of baseball. Teams play well and then they play like shit. That's life. That's baseball. Number two, the roller coaster experience that is Hector Neris. His ability to not only walk two guys but also strike out the side in the same inning is brilliant and heart racing. And all that stuff. And yesterday in the doubleheader, it came back to bite him because he could not get back from that procrastination effort. I think it's just also the bullpen not being as good as it was for the first 12 innings of the season, which we all expected. There was no expectation for that to continue to be god tier as it was for the first few games. And like you said, them only getting that one win on the controversial play at the plate. Now, granted, they did have some very good late game offense to help them there. That was an overall very entertaining game even before that play. That was the best game I've watched all year in terms of just entertainment value. It's just back-to-back, like, dingers and all kinds of clutch hits kind of thing. And the Phillies' clutch offense is still here. That's a good thing to point out. I don't know how they do it. They don't string together hits very often, but when they do, they seem to be at the perfect time.
Yeah, it's their offense has been pretty peculiar, and I honestly look at it as a good sign that they are at this point more adept to getting clutch hits as opposed to consistent production. Because, you know, like you said, the peaks and valleys, consistent offensive production is going to come. But the fact that they're able to get these big hits so early in the season, I think, is a good sign moving forward. That's something that I think will stay with them for most of the season. So I would prefer, if we had to choose one between consistent offensive production and the ability to get clutch hits, I would rather them be in the position they are now. And, hey, the offense is still hitting well. I mean, they are top 10 in the NL in average in hits, in on-base percentage. Like they're still performing well, even with a couple of zeros in the lineup right now. Center field is a complete disaster. It is currently a black hole in the lineup. It is a second pitcher spot in the field. It is complete ineptitude. Roman Quinn is having one of the worst starts to a season I remember for a Philly in a long time. He's hitting under 0.060, I believe. Adam Haseley is hitting under 200, and neither of them are able to play even competent center field defense, which is one of the reasons why – well, not the main reason, but Mickey Moniak got called up today, which was pretty big news. Now, it did come at the cost of Adam Haseley being added to the restricted list for personal reasons, which is obviously not something we like to see. We hope that Haseley is doing okay, but him being moved to the restricted list freed up a roster spot, and they obviously went with Moniak. Now, Moniak's not going to play tonight against the Mets. He will likely be available off the bench, but it is interesting that they brought up Moniak as opposed to Juan Odubel Herrera, because they could have brought Herrera up without having to make any other move. Haseley being added to the restricted list means he no longer counts against the 40-man. So them being more willing to bring up Moniak, I think, says a lot about Odubel's status as a potential center fielder, as well as Kingery, too. I'm excited to see Moniak play. He's likely not going to – well, he's not starting tonight. There's a good chance he comes in off the bench. But he genuinely cannot be worse than what we've seen these past these first 10 or so games.
Yeah, and what's the harm in finding out? Because, like, it can't get worse, and it could get better, because Moniak was a top draft prospect, clearly for a reason. We have not seen many of those reasons yet, except for a few spring training outings. But it's definitely worth finding out. This is the kind of stuff that I think a lot of professional sports teams honestly just fail to grasp, is like, you selected this player, you put in all these resources to try and help them get better. And then when push comes to shove, when it's time to bleep or get off the pot, you just get off the pot and don't play the guy. It's like, what was the point of going through all that work? You're not going to play it. And I think this is really good for Moniak and really good for really the organization to see what they have in the guy.
I think it was foolish for them to give so many at-bats to Odubel and Travis Jankowski in spring training when it seems, you know, despite Moniak's solid performance, I mean, Moniak was a beast in spring training. I think he still likely was ahead of those two in the depth chart, per se, for the center field job when it ultimately became an issue, because we knew it was going to become an issue with the platoon of Haseley and Quinn. I wish they had given him more opportunities in spring training. And they did give him a lot of at-bats, but he should have gotten more, because it really would have given them a more solid chance to evaluate what he could bring to the team. And it's, you know, it's hopefully it turns out to be lucky that we have a guy like him to be able to step in and take Haseley's place while Haseley deals with whatever he's going through right now. I hope that he does get a chance to pinch hit tonight. Because the Phillies face DeGrom tomorrow, and I would not want to be Mickey Moniak trying to make my first start of the year against who is the best pitcher in all of baseball. So, although if I remember correctly, I think his debut may have been against DeGrom last year. I don't remember, but I think it was against a very solid pitcher.
We are about to find out, aren't we?
Let me see.
Good old internet.
This is great.
Game log 2020. That first game against the Mets.
So where's debut? September 16th,
2020.
All right, well, full disclosure, just had some technical difficulties. And by technical difficulties, I mean I forgot to plug in my laptop like an asshole. But shout out to Zoom, because they automatically record whatever we had talked about. So we aren't completely out of luck. But we did find out what we were mindlessly bantering about while we were away. Mickey Moniak did make his debut against Jacob DeGrom, but, and Alec, I told you there was a but here, he was a pinch runner. He did not face DeGrom. So technically I was right, but the whole point I was trying to make, not only did I let my computer die in the middle of a podcast recording, but the point I was trying to make was completely wrong.
We will let it slide this time.
this time. I promise I won't let it happen again. Try to regain some of the flow we had. I'm excited for Mickey Moniak, just like I was in the spring. Nothing has changed since then. I think he showed that he had developed some little bit more of a hit tool, some power as well. And he'd started barreling up some baseballs. And I know that was spring training, but it's something you have to take into consideration. And like we said, I know spring training is over, but we only pay attention to the good stuff about spring training. So I'm excited to see Moniak. He'll probably get to start tomorrow. The lineup for the Phillies tonight is interesting. They have Didi sitting out, and they're starting Ronald Torres, your boy Ronnie Torres. I think a large reason to that is Didi's defense has been pretty bad, and the Phillies' defense as a whole has been pretty poor to start the season. They, which is one of the things that we kind of anticipated. I really didn't think it was going to have this much of a negative impact on them, though.
Their fielding statistics as of now, and now that you bring it up, well, let's see. Their team fielding independent pitching is actually fine. It's like 4, but their team ERA is, if I can find it, shouldn't be this hard to find. It really shouldn't. Oh, this is bad, man. This is great quality for the
for the listeners. Lol, that's okay.
Their ERA is like slightly higher than that. So the fielding hasn't actually resulted in a lot more runs being created than should have been. So that's good. But you're right, Didi's defense. I mean, he had one play last night where he could have created a double play with Gene, and the two kind of miscommunicated kind of thing, and it resulted in only one out instead of 2. He did have that one nice over the basket catch that we talked about last week, which now feels like a year ago. Alec Bohm is still a plus fielder, but Reese Hoskins kind of slow defensively, not offensively, not at all offensively, but on the other end, same with Didi. Gene, I guess, is fine. He's back to his more natural position, so he's probably getting better. But the center field defense being mediocre does not help either. So having 3 kind of weak links, especially one at a kind of easy position to field, it doesn't make for a very productive overall unit.
Yeah, first base defense is you know, it's whatever. Statistically, it's the least valuable defensive position in all of baseball. So it kind of is whatever. Shortstop and center field are 2 of the most important defensive positions in all of baseball. And they have – Didi's defense has been suspect, and I wouldn't even call the defense center field adequate. If it was adequate by one of the parties involved, they would have won the starting job by now. Neither Roman Quinn nor Adam Haseley are capable defenders in center field. I would still – I know he stinks at hitting, and he's an automatic out. I still would rather watch Quinn play than Haseley, but if given the choice, I would pick neither of them. Didi, it says a lot about, and maybe he's sitting out tonight just because he needs a little bit of a rest, but he's largely been their best offensive player thus far. He has hit 2 home runs already. He's leading the league in RBIs with 9. He's second in batting average behind JT in 9 more plate appearances. So Didi's been mashing. It's just, you know, it's probably a little bit of a combination of they want to give him a day off. He played both legs of a doubleheader yesterday. He's started every other game thus far. You know, his defense has been a little suspect. Now, Torres is not a very capable hitter, but he should be more sound defensively. So I can understand why they made the switch when they did. The Phillies have some needs. They need to figure out center field, and hopefully, you know, Moniak gets up here and sticks and is able to make an impact out there. I think one thing they need is a right-handed bat off the bench. Knapp is a switch hitter, but he's better from the left side, and Torres is not a hitter and likely will only pinch hit when absolutely needed to. And I think another thing they need is some depth in the starting rotation. The Matt Moore and Chase Anderson experiments have been suspect at best. And they each have started to get off to slow starts in each of their last 2 appearances. They settle in a little bit, but they can't you know, you can't have guys who are immediately putting you in a hole out there. So I think that's another area they need to explore.
Yeah, you always need more pitching depth in general, but it's especially been concerning. I mean, one idiot on the a previous episode said that he wasn't worried about Matt Moore. So it's unfortunate that things have gone the way they have here. You can feel free to clown him anytime you want. That would be me we're talking about. Yeah, me.
I think we both probably tried to justify Matt Moore to ourselves. But, you know, you live and you learn.
Yeah, it's fine. And Anderson also not great so far. I think the front office knew that they wouldn't necessarily pan out to be great. They just hoped that they would. That's why the two didn't cost that much. It cost like $7 million combined to acquire the two. So I don't really like – they were still fine shots to take. Like, it's not really a big deal. Yet it will be a big deal in June when those spots still haven't been filled out. But I think for now, it's not really – we don't need to overreact to anything like that yet. But center field you're talking about, there is a certain center fielder that the Phillies could get if another team starts to be bad enough. That'd be Brandon Nimmo, who we consider to be Ken's favorite player. Oh. The two of us strongly disagree on a certain topic around Brandon Nimmo. Oh. Some of you might have seen this discussion on Twitter. A guy got into it with me over this discussion. So, Ken, why don't you introduce our favorite player to the group?
Okay. The walk – oh, God, you completely caught me off guard with this. The sprinting to first base thing he does after a walk sucks, okay? It's so lame. And he's such a dislikable guy. I don't understand why you're going to continue to attempt to defend that. It's awful. It is infuriating every time I see it. He's my least favorite player in the league right now because of it.
I just don't understand, he doesn't – it's just him being him. Like, I thought the whole point of, like, progressive baseball fans and, like, young fans who, like, love dingers and love seeing guys celebrate is that they express individuality. Like, yeah, I thought that was the whole point.
But that's for cool shit. That's for home runs. It's not a walk.
Hey, walksers –
act like you've been here before, bud. You're not a freshman trying to make a baseball team. All right. You don't need, oh God, it's awful. It's stupid. And okay, fine. If he's going to do that, then when you get K'd up, then sprint back to the dugout. If that's your thing. Oh, it's infuriating. I really dislike this guy.
I just don't care. Now, granted, the political stuff has been brought up, which I really did. Yeah, that's not great that gets added in.
He has some pretty suspect beliefs. But he's got such a punchable face. We always need a villain, and he plays for the Mets. There's nothing I don't know how much more I can say about it. It's egregiously lame.
Maybe I'll come around to hating the Mets more as they continue to be good at the same time as the Phillies. But the fact is, when the Phillies were good, the Mets were sort of good and then collapsed right in front of our faces in 2007 and 2008. And then ever since then, the Phillies were bad when the Mets were good. And that 2015 World Series was one of the Phillies' most dreadful times to be a Phillies fan. So, I mean, this is the first time in a while that both teams have been roughly going the same way. So maybe I will start to dislike them more. I just haven't. Same thing with the Nationals for a while. I just didn't care. But maybe that fire will come back and maybe I will hate Nimmo. But for now, I just, if a player has a thing that they do, like, I don't care. Just do whatever. I am completely the antithesis of whatever the frick the Yankees are doing with you must shave your head when you come. Like, Rougned Odor doesn't even look like himself anymore after that trade. That's the thing. Yeah, I could rant about that forever.
That, the Yankees beard thing, that objectively sucks too. But it's just lame. It's not fine. I'm not saying he can't do it. I'm not saying they should throw at him, because I think that's such a lame argument people make when somebody pimps a home run. They should get a fastball in the ribs.
That's so lame. That's so stupid.
I'm not saying he shouldn't do it. I'm just saying it is objectively uncool what he's doing, and it's stupid, and he looks like a loser. I'm sorry, he does. And I will say, your point to the Phillies and Mets not being good at the same time in a while, the NL East is going to be very, very contentious this year. I hate the Braves. The Braves hate us. I hate the Mets. The Mets hate us. We haven't played the Nationals yet, but I'm sure I'm going to hate them too, which I already do. But I made a joke to my girlfriend the other day. She was FaceTiming while I was watching the game last night, actually. And I said, I was talking about how much I hate the Mets. And I said, I hate the Mets and the Braves more than any other teams in baseball. And at any given moment, my least favorite team, which is whichever of those two teams we're playing. So the NL East is going to be very contentious this year. You saw it with the Boehm play at home. You saw it in the Mets series when they thought that Jose Alvarado was throwing at Michael Conforto. First of all, very bold of you to assume he knows where he's throwing.
Exactly.
But yeah, I'm excited. I'm really excited for the NL East this year. It's going to be a battle. And it's teams that do not like each other. So we'll have to see how it shapes out.
Yeah, I'm also excited for the NL East because – and the one team you didn't even mention got to the second round of the playoffs last year, the Marlins.
The Marlins stink. I'm not
worried. Hey, we don't know that. I mean, went 500 last year, a little over that, got to the – won a playoff series. Anything's possible.
The Marlins and the Nationals both stink. I'm not complaining about it. Juan Soto is good. Juan Soto is a fantastic player, but they stink. And I will say Jazz Chisholm is cool on the Marlins. The dude that hit he hit the first home run off of a 100-mile-an-hour pitch out of the zone, and he hit it off the Grom, obviously, which is sick. Since I think Statcast had began or something, which is awesome. So yeah, I mean, the NL East is a lot of passion, a lot of passion.
To tie up the loose end from the Nimmo argument, we'll probably be putting out a poll on Twitter, possibly one on Instagram too, for you guys to decide what you think about Brandon Nimmo's run to first base.
I guarantee you the poll will lean heavily in my favor. I
really? Okay. Okay.
I promise you. You're the only person I've seen who has defended it. That's it's such an easy thing to dislike.
I was the only person who liked the process in this city for like fucking months.
But the process is your team. That's where my confusion comes from. He plays for the Mets, man.
It's more like I'm coming from a sense of apathy. You're coming from a sense of he already sucks because of who he plays for.
I get it. Well, no, I think anybody that did it looks lame. I don't care who you
play. So if Roman Quinn did it, you would mind?
I would probably think it was dumb. Yeah, I would obviously be more obviously because he's on my team. But I think it's dumb. I think it's cooler to pimp a walk like McCutchen does than it is to sprint the first. I'm telling you, it just gives me freshman first day of tryout vibe. Like, dude, you're in the major leagues. All right, you can relax.
You keep the same energy with all the I respect it.
Stuff is cool, is what I'm saying. Like everybody was pissed when Acuña celebrated that home run. Whatever. He hit a moonshot. He said after the game it was the hardest he's ever hit a ball. That's fine. Don't let him hit the home run. Throw a strike to this damn Nimmo guy. Don't let him get on base. Let him do his weak little infield hits that he does.
The Phillies literally they tied the game yesterday on a stupid infield single.
We are a 16th of the way into the season, and I could write a book about 2020.
It's already losing it.
I could write a book about 2021. Hey, you know what? We're still in first place, so that's all that matters.
That is all that matters. 6-5 in first place.
6-5 in first place. Pennant's not won in April, though. So I think that's going to do it for us, unless you want to light another fire under me before we get going.
I've had my fun.
All right. Well, that was good. After our mishap with the technical difficulties, we owed the listeners a little bit of excitement there. But that's going to do it for us this week. Draft week next week, we will have a special guest. Vinny Colavita will join us next week. We actually haven't talked to him about that, but what's he going to say? No.
Follow. He can't say no.
No, he can't. He can't say no. Talk to us, follow us on Twitter at Something Philly. Check out the website, alwayssomethingpod.com. There's too many things to remember. Follow me on Twitter at Ken the Ben. Follow Alec at AlecNBA. Download Viget, use promo code Philly when you sign up. And Alec, give us something to take us into the rest of the week.
Alec Boehm was safe.
Okay, I agree. I mean, he like literally was called safe and they won the game for it. So I don't know how you could disagree. He was ruled safe after video review. That'll do it for us. We'll talk to you guys next week. We'll be right back.